Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything we think we know about food. I'm Anthony Zara, and this episode was recorded live at the Food Matters Live Sustainable Food Forum held in London in September. This session was titled, What Mainstreaming Sustainable Food Consumption Looks Like. Our panel discusses how the food industry can help consumers eat more sustainably, what's required to bring about this transformation, and where the challenges and opportunities are for the sector. Your host is the journalist and broadcaster, Samira Ahmed.
I need to declare a bit of an interest. I wrote a column which is in the new issue of New Humanist magazine. It's online for free. And it was about my ambivalence about some of the new meat substitute products. And I particularly wrote a sentence, which may haunt me as I'm in your presence, Andy, but I describing served a vegan sausage as part of a vegetarian breakfast, which looked so disconcertingly like pork that I had to ask my meat-eating companion to test it. He couldn't tell. And I decided that that sausage was to vegan cookery what porn is to genuine lovemaking, a capitalist abomination. And I'm utterly willing to be convinced otherwise. But I think it's a reminder of, for those of us who've been vegetarian for many decades, the current picture of consumption can feel quite confused. And perhaps it's a generational thing, but I'm really interested in absolutely embracing all these dilemmas that there are. So each of our panel is going to speak for about 3 minutes about some of these issues, you know, how consumer food choices are influenced, how far they influence themselves, what sustainability means in terms of a healthy diet and affordability for the consumer, and how we can make changes to help consumers eat more sustainably and what's required. So I'll introduce them by name and then we'll hear from each of them. Fabia Bromowski is from the Sustainable Food Trust. Andy Shovel is from This, which is one of the, I think, the fastest growing food companies in Britain, hugely successful. Alex Smith is from Alara Whole Foods, and Dr. Anne Trevenan-Jones is from the Global Alliance for Improved Nutrition and has worked for 25 years, particularly on urban health and food. So I'll get you to start, Fabia, set out your thoughts.
Okay, so one of the questions put to us was, you know, how can the food industry collaborate to help consumers make sustainable choices? Well, I would say there's a very easy answer. First of all, we have to put sustainable food on our food shelves. I don't think there are very many products that we will find in our supermarkets that are truly sustainable. And of course, you know, food starts on the farm. Well, some of it now starts in the laboratory, but the food that we should be eating starts on the farm. And therefore, it's there that we have to really address this idea of what is a sustainable system, what is a sustainable farming system. And to be sustainable at that level, it's not to be sustainable in one aspect. We seem to have more recently muddled up sustainability with, say, net zero. Net zero, a perfectly commendable goal, reducing carbon emission and greenhouse gases as an important factor of one of our global warming conditions. But actually, the sustainability of the system requires on a much more holistic and balanced approach to nature, to climate. We live in an interconnected system in which we are a part. And if we don't get the balance right at farm level, if we don't start with the microbiome of our soil and watch that move up into the health and the nutritional density of our food, we are missing what sustainability looks like. So firstly, if we are going to actually collaborate to have more sustainable food, we need to take that back to farm level. We need to ensure that first we have a sustainable system there for people, planet, economically viable for the farmer, but making sure that we have the whole balance of nature aligned. What is there that we can do to help transform our system? We need to understand what that means, and we need transparency in our food system so that when our food gets to the consumer, we understand where it started and that it did actually come from a sustainable system at farm level in its production process. There are many other pieces in the chain, all of which we need to look at with the same level of scrutiny that piece of the jigsaw is solved for in terms of a sustainable system. We are using the resources of nature. We've already extensively extracted over our entitlement in that system. Hence, the new words out there, the new word on the BOP, regen. That's only because we have a hole to fill. We need to build that up. But until we're sustainable, we cannot start to regenerate the things, the resources that we've lost. So it's a step along that road.
Fantastic. Thank you. Andy.
Captain Predictable, I've got it in for meat and dairy, animal products. And I think first half of my 3 minutes, I'll talk about what I see the problem is. And then I'll try and touch on potential solutions. I'm sure we'll delve into those later as well together. But in terms of the problem, there are, I think, about 7 billion of us on the planet. And we successfully, which we struggle, by the way, to feed all of us, we all know. And we successfully feed and nurture 80 billion animals a year. That's farmyard animals. And if you include fish, which obviously we don't feed, but we consume, it goes up to close to a trillion. So that's about a trillion animals to feed 7 billion people. It's absolutely...
I should say we do feed a lot of fish, farmed fish.
Of course, yeah, we do. But of course, the majority of fish we catch are not farmed. And so the numbers are astonishing. I mean, I'll go on for just a second about them because it is worth hearing. And I know it's kind of boring when a crazy vegan starts talking about this, but it is nice to think about the substantial factors here, the numbers. About 77% of our agricultural land in the world is used for animal agriculture. And yet animal agriculture only accounts for 17% of the food we actually eat globally. If you put in, there's no such thing as sustainable meat or sustainable dairy, and there's no such thing as cruelty-free meat or dairy. And just to talk about the efficiency for half a second, if you put in 50 kilocalories to a cow, you'll get out the other end 1 kilocalorie. So it's 50 to 1 in terms of efficiency or inefficiency. It's absolutely bonkers. And I know it's sort of like becoming white noise because we hear about it so much, but it's kind of for good reason. It is absolutely a crazy way to feed the planet. Just finally on the numbers, I guess, amounting to the problem, almost if I had time, I'd do audience participation in this because it's quite fun. But to skip that, 75% of the animal mass in the world, so in other words, all the weight of animals in the world, or number of animals really is the same thing, are domesticated. So they're in the farming system. I mean, just think about it. You think about all these animals in the Amazon and all these animals everywhere under the sea. It's crazy. Almost all of our animals in the world now are domesticated and we use them for food. So that's the problem. In terms of solution, I know I'm personally very synonymous with meat alternatives, being co-founder of our company, This. But I think they're probably a transitional step. I think they're part of the solution, small part of the solution, probably. We need to start focusing, especially with today's narrative, on affordable, whole food-based, healthy plant-based alternatives and give more choice to consumers in that respect. Because I think there's quite a big gap between, say, tofu and seitan, these kind of more legacy foods, which frankly people haven't adopted in the mass market really, and they've had them for long enough to try. And there's a big gap between those taste-wise and the meat alternatives we make, which are great for taste, but then they sometimes miss on nutrition and health. So there's a big gap to fill in terms of leveling up that kind of tofu, seitan area using whole foods and healthy ingredients. So I think I'm probably close to my 3 minutes, so I'll leave it there for now.
There's going to be lots to talk about. Alex.
So I've got 3 minutes and I'm going to cover three subjects. The first subject is why moving to sustainable food is vital. The second is what sustainable food actually is. And the third is the next step I'd like to see in sustainable food becoming mainstream. So why I think sustainable food is vital. Before I started my business, I lived for a year without using money. Now, I'll let you into a secret. It was very easy. The lady I was living with at the time got a bit fed up with it after a year. But I found it impossible to live without food. So everybody here, if you don't get food, you'll die. Now, I think that makes it quite an important subject. The second reason is because, as we've heard in previous sessions, the food supply chain is 1/3 of all climate change gas. Well, let's not go for the climate change. Let's go for climate chaos, climate disaster. one-third of climate disaster gas comes from the food supply chain globally. One-third of that is from nitrous oxide, from artificial fertilizer. One-third is deforestation, and one-third is all the rest of it. So if we don't get to a sustainable food supply chain, we are done. All of us, we're done. So these are two important reasons. Now, my second subject is what sustainable food is. Now, I made one or two little notes here because I've got some acronyms here. We've got B Corp, we've got CRS, we've got ESG, we've got FDTP, we've got IDG, we've got Client Earth, we've got triple bottom line. These are all some of the attempts that there are out there now to say what sustainable food is. The key thing that everybody here needs to remember that a sustainable food system is going to have is it's going to have a key metric, at least one key metric, in the four foundations of sustainability. It's going to have a metric in economic. I've got a business. If I go bust, I'm not sustainable. It's going to have an environmental metric. It's going to have a social metric. And it's going to have a governance metric. Without all of those four metrics in place, you're going to have greenwashing if you don't have a governance. You're going to go bust if you don't have economic. You're going to screw people over if you haven't got social. And you're going to destroy the planet if you haven't got environmental. So you've got to have all of those four systems in place. Now, my business was the very first cereal company in the world to be certified organic. We've been talking about various agroeconomic, you know, agroecological and all the rest. Organic is the only global system for food supply where there is a proper governance system. Europe has said we're going to go 30% organic by 2030, and you look and see what the Chinese are doing. China has seen that this is the future of food. I'm going to Enuga next month specifically to look for organic Chinese ingredients.
Interesting. Did you have one more point that you wanted to make?
One more point.
Briefly, yeah.
The next step I'd like to see for sustainable food, Tesco has tried Jack's, they've tried Fresh and Easy. I'd like them to try Tesco Organic.
And finally, Dr. Anne Trevin and James.
Hi, so perhaps from a different perspective. Again, is obviously our geographies that we focus on are very much Africa and Southeast Asia. Perhaps turning it on its head, people often think that we suffer a lot from hunger, we suffer a lot from undernourishment. It's also something that you have globally, the challenge of not having the right quality food, not just enough food for energy. So for us, sustainability is very much, how do we live within that planetary diet? We're not over-prescriptive in the sense that we know that many of our communities, for example, in Mozambique, animal source foods like eggs and fish are part of the protein and micronutrient diet. That is the reality of it. They're not doing it on a wholesale basis, but we do know Africa can leverage something like at the last Agri conference, $1 trillion, of which 70% of those are in small, medium enterprises. So we very much work with partners. We're in alliance, so we're based in our different countries. We work with partners who are in the public sector, private sector, and nonprofit, kind of in a systems approach. We're not on the farm. We work with Regen10 and organize and coalitions like that to connect with. But if you grow food that is diverse, that is in tune with the planet, it still needs to go somewhere. And we have this tension between the value chain coming into cities, for example. We're seeing the influence of urbanization expanding way beyond city boundaries to affect how even rural communities eat. So they're eating bad stuff now and convenient stuff just as much as we have in the urban cities. So we're trying to look at how do we connect systems, how do we connect governance that reaches beyond administrative boundaries, how do we connect different players together with innovation. And from our side, it's very much looking at technology in smart ways, not only in terms of how do we do smart, cool technology into traditional informal markets where a huge amount of consumers come and talk to their vendors. They have those relationships. They want to know about food. They don't want to know about the usual foods. And there's a lot of reconnection happening in those markets. There's a lack of leverage by the private sector. I always say if you look at M-Pesa, which is a financial tool that everybody said it would never work, you can't offer financial services to the informal food sector. Well, it's a boom in every town that I visit, no matter how remote it is. People can transact in small amounts in food. There's a huge amount of opportunity, not just in technology, but in systems and connecting back to what was grown there before in terms of biodiversity, but also in climate change.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. So I've got four areas that I want to see if we can get through before we take some audience questions. One is, can you concisely talk about what we're talking about when we talk about a sustainable diet? Because it feels like there might be a big gap between what we think that means in the affluent north and what it might mean in the developing countries of the world. I don't know if you want to go first on that.
Well, through our partners, including EAT, we do listen to a lot of the research around the planetary diet, and that has been an important signaller for us. But how is it then socialised in our different communities, in our different areas? Because place and context really matters, but then how do you connect regionally and how do you scale up? So for us, it's not about sustaining enough food for people to continue. It's about nourishing. It's about having diversity and living within that balance that we know with the boundaries, not just focusing only on climate change. We tend to always be in a responsive mode with climate change and disasters, drought and locusts, for example. We're much more interested in sort of saying also biodiversity, also water. How does it all connect in from a systems point of view? Because food is not just as it comes into the processing thing. We're also thinking how it's utilised. What fresh water, how do people cook with it? So for us, it's beyond that kind of chain.
Thank you. Andy, what about for you?
So to continue my slightly boring theme, the race to curb our greenhouse gas emissions would be bent completely out of shape if we all stopped eating animal products today. So I know that's obviously a completely idealistic idea, but if we did, just for the sake of thought experiment, at the moment, animal ag represents 15 to 18% of greenhouse gas emissions globally. So to give you an idea of context, that's significantly more than all transport combined, all planes, trains, cars in the world. So if you cut that out overnight, forget all the land use implications, by the way, you get like 4 billion hectares back. And everything else. If you did overnight move to a plant-based diet as a global society, then the climate change debate would completely cease how we know it today and be something completely different. Mm-hmm. So in my mind, I like to keep things really, really simple. I sort of have to, actually. and I would say that sustainable food, in my opinion, is food that's not derived from animals.
At all. Okay. And Fabia?
And I'm going to challenge Andy on the ability that we could live in a world that was entirely plant-based. And as I was going to say, I speak from the seat of a vegetarian, but my worldview has had to change, in that in order to restore our soils without using chemical inputs that have destroyed the structure of our soils, have destroyed the habitats of our rivers, et cetera, biodiversity and climate, we require our livestock to play a part in that system. I completely agree with you on many, many levels that livestock are there to change the cellulose in our grass into protein, but do many other things. Eating beef or eating, you know, the use of livestock is not a one-trick pony. It does not just provide protein. It provides so many other parts of our diverse ecosystem and the interrelationship between the good bugs and the bad bugs that are both protecting our crops and our other parts of the planet. So I come back to, we need a system in balance. We certainly don't need the kind of meat levels that we have today, because so much of our meat production is done by intensive feedlots, eating the wrong kind of food, which are taking up much of that land use that you refer to. So I'm going to start from there. In terms of a sustainable diet, again, that's a very, very difficult and complex question, because diet could be how we consume it in our bodies, or we can talk about how it's produced. Regen 10, so we spent a lot of time looking at how we can change the way it's produced on the ground so that we're producing our commodities in balance with nature. We talk now, as I say, about this word regenerative systems. Regenerative systems are about changing the whole way we produce our food, because rather than thinking I'm a wheat grower or I'm a cocoa grower, we have to think about rotational systems and introducing lots and lots of different skills into that livestock. So down there, that's part of it. With EMF, we've been looking at this project, which we call the Great Food Redesign Challenge, which is to say, what does it mean to have a regenerative food product that the consumer can feed? And we look at diversity. Diversity is a hugely important part of a sustainable diet. We know that in nature and in all things, in order to get the balance of all the things we need in our body, we need a diverse intake of food, you know, which we've taken out in our very ultra-processed food. We need to think about all the processing that goes on and the packaging and all the impact that has. We need to think about waste. Waste, again, I would like to just slightly challenge the fact we can produce enough food for our 70 billion people. But what we are doing at the moment is we're wasting between 30 and 40% from production to the end. That's a massive statistic. If we can change the waste balance.
Why are we wasting that percentage?
We're wasting it at every single level in the process. So we're wasting it in how we collect it on farm, partly because of our what we consider as acceptable for the market.
Okay.
So we waste a lot of there. We're wasting it through processing. And we're wasting it because we all put too much food on our plate and we throw it away.
Okay, thank you. Sorry, Alex, your thoughts on just defining a sustainable diet?
I'll come back to these foundations. A sustainable diet has to be affordable. It has to meet the requirements of the environment. It has to be social. I mean, food, let's go for a coffee, fancy a drink. Oh, how about having a meal together? Food is social. So it has to encompass that social aspect, and it has to be, I'll move away from the word governance, I'll use the word transparent instead in this case. So we need to have a system that's transparent, so you know what's in the food. It is food in the food, not food-like substances. You need to know what you're eating. So these four elements, I'd say, are key to a sustainable food. You know, if I'm buying food, I've got a factory, so I'm quite lucky. I had my porridge this morning. It came from a farm in Scotland. You know, it's the only oat mill in the world where they still use water mill and kilning rather than steam. You know, so I'm very lucky. I've got a very good supply of food coming into me. So those four elements are key.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting is, in a way, you represent the purist on the panel, the idealist, because you're talking about making consumer choices, which, one, are not open to everyone, but also are very driven by your ethical stance. And I wanted to take us into the challenging situation we're in, where certainly in the UK, maybe particularly in cities, there's a sort of bit of a bubble where it can feel like plant-based eating has become, I should use the word fashionable, even though we know vegetarianism and veganism have been around for thousands and thousands of years. And I wanted to ask you, Andy, as someone who's kind of a very successful innovator in the field of, you know, plant-based alternatives and is obviously very ethically committed to this, what your view is of how sustainable that way is, or you seem to hint that perhaps it's only a sort of way station on the long road to changing how we eat and our relationship with animal products.
So I've always spent time, I've been a founder for a long time, actually 16 years, and so I've always tried to spend loads of time trying to decode what's a fad and what's a sustainable kind of shift in society. And I think the way that you do that is you look at the causal factors and how substantial or fickle they are. So for instance, the move to coconut water, do you remember what happened a few years ago? The reasons for that were not very substantial. They were mostly just sort of herd driven by consumers. When you look at and you can go on and on about different kind of, let's say, fads. Mm-hmm. If you look at the reason that people want to reduce their meat intake and therefore eat more plant-based products, the reasons are extremely substantial. They are the environmental factors, which I just touched on earlier, of which there are millions of other ones. There are the ethical factors, because a lot of people now are beginning to understand how their animal products are produced. and they don't want their lunch to have quivered in fear or to experience pain before they ate it.
And the reduction in dairy is very significant in that.
Yeah.
It's not just about meat.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And eggs as well. Yeah. Eggs is a brutal industry, which people just don't know a lot of this stuff. And then obviously the health benefits as well. If you go for a mostly whole food-based, plant-based diet, then the health benefits are numerous.
But I'm going to take you on to the other side of it, which is the type of products that someone like this makes, which is very different to, if you look back at vegetarianism, you know, in the 60s and 70s, which is very much about sourcing things like, you know, lentils and legumes, eating the way that other cultures had been eating.
But a dark time for vegetarians in the 70s and 60s.
Well, you may say so.
I've heard. But yeah, sorry, go on.
Well, so I'm just wondering, I mean, obviously people look at some of the new products which are directly trying to ape meat products, and they question, one, how far there's ultra-high processing, but also, is this really the way to get people to think differently? Yeah. If you're just substituting meat for something that looks and tastes like it.
So the first bit of a question I'll take first.
Yeah.
The ultra-processed, how healthy is it really? So what I think we're sometimes tempted to do is compare our plant-based bacon or our plant-based sausage to like an aubergine. And we're not substituting aubergines or carrots or lettuce. We're substituting bacon and pork sausages. And then when you start to compare fairly with the products that we're directly substituting, the conversation starts to get very different, because animal bacon contains nitrates, which causes
cancer.
But
no one's really making that comparison. They're making comparison between eating genuinely vegetarian or vegan products rather than trying to create a mimic.
Well, what are those genuine vegetarian or vegan products?
Cereals,
vegetables.
Fruit,
vegetables. Well, an aubergine is a vegetable.
Yeah.
So I am.
Eat one.
I'm on the front line of this, right? Like I get it. And people, when they're having this debate, they say, well, actually, these products, these plant-based bacon products, they're not as healthy as proper whole foods like vegetables or cereals. Yeah. But we're not replacing vegetables and cereals. We're replacing bacon and sausages. So we have to compare our products' health credentials with that of bacon and sausages. We're 93% less sat fat than bacon.
Okay, but that's a very specific choice.
Half the salt.
So to compare yourself to those.
Products.
Okay, no, that's fair enough.
If we made a highly processed aubergine replacement, I'd be very happy
I take the point, but I think let's get the rest of the panel on this, because this is one of the big dilemmas at the moment in what's happening with discussions about sustainable and non-meat and animal-based eating. And I don't know if you all want to throw in your opinions. Alex next, and then Anne and Fabia.
Certainly. I've been, as you pointed out, rather purist.
And that's not meant as a criticism.
No. I didn't take it that way. You know, and I've been very, very lucky in that I started a business with two pans I found on the street. On the very, you know, my business is the first certified organic cereal company in the world. I've been claiming we're the most sustainable food manufacturer on earth. I've been making that claim for a while. I've been challenged several times, and so far I've fought off all of the challenges. And I have, you know, a really amazing life. So to that degree, I've been, you know, I mean, I'm 70. I don't look 70. I've been eating well for a long time now. And, you know, I have a great life. I've got a fantastic team. And one of the reasons I've been purist is that I've never put sugar in our products, and I've never put expanded, or you know, you can take flour and you can grind it all up and you can then puff it. You know, it's what most cereals are made of. And I've never, ever done that. So I've always avoided ultra processing, you know. And one of the things I often get talked about is, oh, you've got organic food, it's really expensive and all the rest of it. Now, I've got a product in Sainsbury's now. Well, I'll take this one product in Sainsbury's because it's the best example. It's net zero carbon. We've worked with, you know, we put scope 3 CO2e on the pack.
I'm going to ask you, Alex, sorry, to be relatively concise in this.
So I'll be quick. So to cut to the chase, our organic sustainable cereal on Sainsbury's shelf is 40 pence 100 grams. Kellogg's Corn Flakes is 70 pence 100 grams. So anybody who says they can't afford proper organic sustainable food when it's more or less half the price of Kellogg's Corn Flakes doesn't quite understand what's what.
Okay, that, Thank you.
That's to the chase.
Anne?
I guess we're much more in the business of how do we bring this to practical implementation? You know, how do we take it down to the ground so it really is having that impact? And rather than on substitutes, which I can understand is a high-income city consideration, we're much more saying, what can we fill in the gap when we don't have greens? We go back to that argument of affordability. Affordability is really complex to determine. It's not just that in many of our countries it's between $3.5 and $4 US per person per day to afford food, and it's usually bought in small amounts, and fruits and vegetables are the most expensive. So we're trying to sort of think about how can we stabilize that system? How can we, when there's gaps in availability, instead of encouraging people to bring food across multiple borders, say, what else can we fill in those gaps? What used to grow here? What did your grandparents? So that reconnection, which I think you mentioned, which is more than just social, reconnecting with different varieties, different ways of growing food, and having those available in the market space. Because it's one thing to grow, and many of our growers, one of the challenges they're saying, oh, what if we go back to this? Will there be demand? And so we're constantly faced with that, and we're trying to change consumers' perceptions by, if they see it, if it looks good and it smells good, and they can think, oh, my grandmother used to work with this as well in the bean salad, and that'd be nutritious, trying to connect those dots from our side.
That's interesting, trying to connect the multi-generational side as well. Fabia?
I think to that last point, one of the vital things that we need to do to help educate us as consumers is to reconnect the dots, to the food that we actually produce on the ground and get closer to food in its natural state. We have found an incredible system in the last 50 years that has been able to feed the planet. There are lots of things that disrupt that food chain, not all of them to do with our ability to produce it. But what we haven't succeeded is in how to get the correct nutrition of our planet. We know that obesity now outweighs what we would have considered as starvation, but both of them, both undernourishment and obesity, are considered nutritionally undernourished. And so something in the way that we have produced our food has taken the nutritional part, the health part, out of our food in pursuit of cheap food. So I think it really is bringing it back to understanding food as it's produced and how we can celebrate that in our diet more than replace it with substitutes that they're not without being part of a solution, but we must be careful not to create the vape for our tobacco.
Well, that's a really interesting comparison. And I suppose there's the charge, isn't it, that comes about greenwashing, that particularly some very, very big brands have jumped on the plant-based eating bandwagon. And we've seen some of those companies already start to drop products. You've obviously started from scratch. And I just wondered, how would you deal with the fact that it can feel that there are greenwashing products out there that, you know, claim to be plant-based, but really it's just about spotting a market and jumping on it without being committed to the issues that underlie it? I mean, how would you deal with that?
Capitalist opportunism is different from greenwashing, and I worry that we're conflating the two, because if say some massive meat company brings out a meat alternative and claims that it's more environmentally friendly than the meat alternative it's replacing, I suspect they're probably being factual.
That's not necessarily greenwashing.
So it might not necessarily be greenwashing. Yeah. We might be objecting to, I'm saying we, you might be objecting to the bandwagonism by these big companies in our space, which is fine. But
it's mainly to do with the processing, high processing, and the amount of sugar and fat that's going in. So in terms of sustainability, if depending on how you define it, it's not achieving sustainability.
Generally, in the plant-based category where our company operates, there aren't any virtually products which are high in sugar. And generally speaking, the products which are high in fat will be replacing products in the meat world which are even higher in fat, so for instance, sausages and bacon. And I think, you know, just to be talking about vapes and porn and all the rest of it, don't hold back. I think the question we have to ask ourselves, and our consumers ask themselves, is would you prefer animal bacon with all of its sat fat and salt and nitrates and ethical problems and environmental problems, or do you want a highly processed pea, which is what we sell, basically?
Yeah.
So the answer for me is I'd rather have highly processed peas that are way healthier for me in terms of sat fat, Don't cause me cancer from nitrates that we found in bacon and sausages. Don't have you know, all sorts of funny body parts in them. Don't have lots of suffering in their supply chain. Don't have the environmental massive footprint. That's why I'd probably rather have the highly processed peas. Thanks. And so in the future, I have a vision, like every self-important CEO, I have a vision for our company. And that vision is that we don't just sell meat alternatives that are sort of ultra processed. I want us to move into the next few years into really ultra healthy and virtually unprocessed products, which are plant-based, so that we have the occasion covered for when people want to have that tasty bacon in the morning, but they don't want to have all the downsides. And then we also have the workhorse protein for the rainy Wednesday night, when they don't necessarily want to have anything processed, but they do want to be healthy, and they want all these other upsides of going plant-based. So that's the vision anyway.
That's really interesting. Fabia?
Can I just respond? I don't disagree with anything you say. Just going to go to that ultra-processed pea, making sure that we know where that pea comes from, and that pea is part of a system that is not depleting nature.
Yeah.
So, yes, it's a legume, but intensive pea cropping without any other things in that system or with huge chemical inputs is just as damaging as a monocrop of wheat or what anything else. So making sure that at the beginning that the sustainability of that system still exists, firstly, and the ultra-processed, you know, there's so much still to learn about all these things.
And obviously Andy's company is one in a world of everyone using peas, so no one's expecting one company to...
And anything that transitions us away from, you know, other products that are doing worse damage, you know, good.
Anne, and then Alex, and then we'll take questions.
Well, obviously, high salts and fats, it's very difficult to isolate them, and we find convenience foods. So Indonesia, you mentioned, where we have the problem of overweight and underweight, undernutrition exists coexisting side by side. And a lot of it has to do with convenience and affordability, just easier to buy something, have it deep fried in a little market before you go on and take it home. Your children are fed. So for us, it's more complex. It's about attracting people maybe back to the right foods, but not in being, you know, it's not good enough. People don't want to be told this is the right kind of food to eat. They won't be driven to suddenly change their diets because of that. And we need to empower consumers much more, as well as we have like workforce nutrition, where we work with the private sector to kind of train up their workforce to actually sort of say, do you know where your food comes from? Ask the basic questions, think about this, what could work for you? And so it's very much also a two-way learning. We're not only sharing about what could work, but also learning what isn't working for you in a dialogue so that we can reshape a food environment that better responds to allowing people to see these shifts in their diets. Yeah. It's not as easy as just saying don't cook with oil, because if I'm running late and I can see boiled food in Indonesia, I'm just going to quickly take it. So it is complex.
Yeah. Alex, what are your thoughts? So I was thinking partly, you know, there's been a big drive to push for things like eating good quality meat twice a week rather than saying, you know, don't eat meat. Yeah. Is that part of the solution in rethinking consumption?
Certainly, when I was living without using food money, I was living in London and I was catching pigeons. You know, I've got a permaculture forest garden around my factory. And
the idea of eating a London pigeon fills me with horror.
Yeah, you are what you eat. Okay?
You know, and I trapped a squirrel, and I've got apples growing there, and I skinned the squirrel, and I, you know, made a nice, you know, I was really back to, you know, okay. I didn't have my, you know, my bare
Alex.
Skin on. Yeah, I went back to paleo, you know. Yeah.
But this is like, fascinating, but that isn't what most people are going to do, is it? You're not advocating that to your average consumer.
But, I mean, what I'm saying, though, is that in lots and lots of cultures, fish and animals are absolutely part of the culture. You know, and it is to move away from that. You know, and we heard, too, that some element of animal... I mean, what I'm proposing is organic.
Okay.
You know, I think that organic is the right route to go. Oh. It's especially got a global governance. And organic will include animal and it will include dairy. But because the costs of those foods are incorporated into the product, then it is going to be much more expensive. So it is going to be a special occasion rather than an everyday occurrence.
It's really interesting seeing how logic logically you've developed this philosophy. Thank you. Fabian, did you want to add something? Then we'll take
just questions. That, I mean, opens a whole new subject, which is the true cost of our food.
Yeah.
And so what Alex is saying is that to eat well, to eat organically, is expensive, but that's only because we're not building in the real cost of it and we're paying for it elsewhere. We have to build the cost of our food into our food, and we need to reduce the costs on our health and on our planet and on our pollution elsewhere.
It just reminded me, there's Obit recently appeared of that New Zealander who specialised in eating roadkill. But anyway, you can look that story up for yourself.
Good recycling.
Let's take a person with the green jacket there, and then I'll take the person with the blue jacket, and we'll take those two questions. And then there's a lady on the end with glasses. So can we take those three? Go for it.
We've talked a lot about different types of diets and what those diets might look like. But the conversation...
Hold it nice and close.
...is about, obviously, mainstreaming that form of eating.
Yeah.
What is the role that communication with consumers has to play in that? Because whatever we decide to do, we have to then convince people to change their behaviour.
Lovely.
So how does that... What does that look like?
Thank you. And then you've got a microphone. Yes. What's your question?
Hi. I'm really interested. You've got four panellists, one of whom is advocating for it's not the how, it's the cow. Not the cow, it's the how. You've got plant-based, you've got organic, and you've got a full systems approach, you know, from developing economies. If we're going to mainstream sustainable food consumption, surely people continuing to argue that their approach is the right approach and that we, you know, is not going to help that situation. I'd be really interested in the panel's views on the spaces between where you are. Like, is it possible to move to a place where it isn't all plant and it isn't continuing with animal, but there is something in between, and maybe it's not fully organic and not regenerate, but there's something in between. I'm really interested in the bits between.
We'll just start talking about that with two days a week, but there was one more. There was one here, yes.
Hi, I'm Matt Uniman. Firstly, I just want to challenge...
Hold it a bit closer.
...made by Fabio about the fact that we can produce enough food to feed the population. I'd argue that we do, but it's just misdirected towards animals, and especially with food waste. You're right, but we do produce, I think it's enough for 12 billion.
Okay.
My question, maybe mainly for Dr. Anne, is we've been eating meat industrially for decades now, and we're saying that other countries need to avoid this, similar with fossil fuels. How do we support developing countries, whatever the right terminology is, to make that transition? We've kind of got it there with the Eat Lancet Planetary Health Diet, but now we tell them what they need to do. How can we support them to doing that without it kind of feeling like we're still instructing and almost those hints of colonialism?
A bit like with fossil fuel burning, isn't it? Thank you very much. I want to put the first two together. So there were questions about how do we communicate with consumers about mainstreaming a sustainable diet, but also the question whether there are spaces between the different positions that everyone on the platform holds. So it is sort of, is there a joined up message that can be promoted that has everyone's interests in common? Who wants to go first? Yeah, go on, Fabia.
Okay, I think there's definitely, you know, we do not have all the solutions in this room. We have different ways of thinking about it. We don't have the solutions. So one of the things that we've been working on is that we need a common way of measuring outcomes. We should stop telling each other how to do things, and we should measure and monitor the outcomes we're having on our planetary systems as we do that. That's the first thing. If we could kind of a common way of collecting sustainability data at farm level that covers those four aspects that we talked about, social, economic, and environmental, then we've got a DNA that can go up through our food chains to meet that labelling that we require at the other end. We don't know all the answers, so we should, as we find new solutions, both in the laboratory and on the farm, we need to make sure that the outcomes from those solutions really meet the things that we have.
Thank you. Andy?
I completely agree. I think my half of my answer would definitely overlap with what you just said, Fabia. I think, and what you've previously said. I think having a really well-indexed labelling system for consumers, which is really easy to understand, a bit like the traffic light system for, the health credentials of products. But you have one of those for, you know, maybe social, water, greenhouse gas, whatever, if you had three or four columns and I think that should be mandated from a central government level as well, for sure, because what's happening at the moment, we get approached every month by a different company saying, oh, we've got the new indexing system for labelling, and they sort of don't really go anywhere, and there's like tens, 20s of them. So I think that needs to be mandated from central government to start educating consumers on the ground, in shops, for sure. But then on the communication, or are we covering this lady in the Greens question?
Yeah, both.
So that was basically, just to recap, that was basically what's in between all your stances. Well, I suppose the in between all our stances is what we have today in a way. You've got some people advocating for plant-based in their daily lives and some people advocating for meat and everything. So I'm not sure I have a great answer to that question, sorry, but because I think our reality today represents your hypothesis of a kind of in-between and straddling all things. Yeah, go ahead, sorry.
Very briefly, because we're out of time.
Just to say that I think the arguments between sort of the different futures are not helping come to a place where we're all moving in the same direction. Mm. And it feels like we're stuck in the space between plant and animal, organic. And it doesn't feel like everybody is, if we want to mainstream this, surely we've got to get to a place where there is a space for all parts of this new future food system and all be singing.
Thank you.
Okay. Can I answer
that? Yeah, do briefly.
So I think the answer is let's look at objective truth and let's not look at whether we feel warm and fuzzy about meat and dairy because it's been in our culture for generations. Let's look at objective truths about what is the environmental impact of these different food groups. And why don't we perhaps legislate and stop subsidizing the incredibly environmentally damaging parts of our food system? So meat and dairy would not exist in the UK without subsidies. It is a business that does not work at all.
That's a really interesting way to flip it around.
So why don't we let free markets and objective environmental truths dictate which direction we take in terms of, you know, the conclusion of the argument so that we're not just in stasis and all bickering at one another. That would be my answer.
Thank you very much. Alex?
One of the big problems we've got with all of this metrics is the indeterminacy of it. I mean, we worked with the Carbon Trust looking at the embedded, you know, scope 3 CO2e in our simplest oat supply chain. That varied from one farm to one process to us between 1.8 tonnes of CO2e to 2.7 tonnes of CO2e, dependent on the weather, how wet the grain was, whether, as one of my suppliers puts it, the grains were donkey's bollocks or pine nuts, or pine needles. So there's that dealing with indeterminacy, and there's indeterminacy in all of these metrics here. Finding a way for society to deal with this indeterminacy rather than thinking there's a very specific answer that you can print on a pack is going to be an extraordinarily difficult thing for society to do.
Thank you. Final thought to Anna, I also wanted you to answer the other question, which was what can be done to support developing countries who are, you know, in the position of perhaps, I mean, countries like India, which have really embraced a lot of things that used to be normal in the north, you know, things like much more meat consumption, processed consumption. How do we support them to make the transition in a way?
Oh, gosh, whole lot of subjects.
Sorry.
I think communication is absolutely essential, but breaking it down. So one of the things GAIN does with, for example, Johns Hopkins University and FAO, we put together food systems dashboards that were initially national to be able to, what do we want the data for? We want the data to actually be able to track, are we making an impact in the planetary boundaries? Where do we stand? And that's almost got a longer horizon than right now what we actually have to do. Are we having an impact? In what way are we getting co-benefits? And from that, we've come to the realize that we need more granular data. If you have data, it's not enough just to have it somewhere. You want consumers to be able to use it in a manageable format. And the way we're not really consistently bringing that down enough, but where we did find, and that was a lesson from COVID, even in places like Spain and Portugal, people started going back to markets. Smallholder farmers came back to markets. They started having conversations. And that is a key tool, that more intimacy, being able to communicate and learn more, where did your food go? So it's more about having shared principles that and learning from best practices that may not be able to be adapted directly to your context, but how can you pick up some of those lessons? And GAIN, for example, is working with more and more bigger consortia, like with WWF, EAT, CARE, where we have different understandings of what sustainable development is. We have different approaches, but we've come together and said, we want to have an impact on 20 secondary or intermediary cities. This is a key growth area that connects small towns, rural communities, and big cities. how do we all come together with some shared agreement of whether it's regenerative agriculture, sustainable agriculture, etc. And so that trend is already moving forward. But it's complex because we all have to get to the table and make compromises.
Fantastic. I think this has been such a brilliant panel. Thank you for your questions. The only thing I would add is when the restaurant Cranks opened up in London, 1968, they chose that title because vegetarianism is regarded as this weird fringe thing. And I think the fact that it's a big mainstream argument is only a positive thing, isn't it? It's that it's part of what everyone's grappling with. So thank you to my terrific panel. Thank you to all of you and for your questions.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, there are hundreds more at foodmatterslive.com. Remember, if you enjoy the Food Matters Live podcast, you can subscribe via your preferred platform. And if you feel inclined, why not leave us a review? Thank you so much for listening.